Hi, everyone. This is Matt Welch. Welcome to The Reason Podcast. Remember, please subscribe to us, rate and review us over at Apple Podcasts and Spotify and etc. From our very first issue, Reason Magazine has always had an optimistic view on the wonders and possibilities of science. Even in a world gone mad back then, as well as now, with gloom and doom, prosperity and ingenuity find a way to march on, delivering people out of poverty, allowing them to escape stifling institutions, and offering a glimpse at a future that even 20 years ago would have seemed pretty far-fetched. So at Reason's 50th anniversary celebration in Los Angeles in November, I had the very good fortune to moderate a panel on the present and future of science with three of the very smartest people I have ever met. Reason science correspondent Ron Bailey, legendary skeptic Michael Shermer, and Reason TV managing editor Jim Epstein, who talked to us about blockchain technology, among other things. Stimulating conversation. I hope very much that you enjoy it. Take a listen.
I have had the great opportunity when I first came to Reason or early on in my career there, I was filling in for either Ron or Brian Doherty or someone. They went on book sabbatical. And so I came in and I was the junior the toilet scrubber for Reason there. But it was in the preparation of our 35th anniversary issue. And Nick said, go read all the back issues. And then pull out stuff that's interesting. So I read every issue of Reason Magazine, and this is was a bit of an introduction to it. And one of the things that really jumped out, even from those early mimeograph things and Lanny Friedlander and all that, there was a bursting enthusiasm for the possibilities of science and what that could bring and sort of the wonders. There's early discussions about what would end up looking like the internet, like in 1969 and 1970 in the pages of Reason. There's a pessimistic time in which that magazine was created, our magazine was created, and yet there's always optimistic takes on the future. And so it's been a great thing for us to have Ron Bailey, a science correspondent, for the last couple of decades at this point.
Yes.
Sorry.
Thank you for pointing that out.
I thought age doesn't mean anything to you anymore, bro. So it's fine. Anyways, so we are going to talk here. Michael Shermer, the great late skeptic over here.
What?
Jim Epstein is the managing editor of Reason TV, and he's going to talk about some crazy blockchain stuff that I can barely grasp. But I think we're going to have Ron set the stage here, talking about 3 to 5 minutes, about the great. I don't know if we have a name for this either, of what's happened in the last 25 years. David Knott referenced last night. We lifted 1 billion people out of poverty worldwide. That's insane. That's an insane number. So talk us through the great, whatever we're calling that. How did that happen? How did we get to that point? And give us sort of a broad happiness, Ron, please.
Everyone calls me an optimist. I just think I'm a realist. I'm telling you what it has happened, not telling you, things that are not true. I just was working this past summer on a book that with a colleague of mine that we're calling tentatively now 10 global trends that every smart person should know, and in parens 67 others you might find interesting. But so I'm going to be cribbing a bit from that, looking about what has happened over the last couple of centuries and what is likely to happen by the year 2100. So we'll begin with the fact of wealth. The fact is that on planet Earth, back in 1820, the world's economy in 2011 international dollars, which I won't explain at this point, but the size of the economy then was $1.2 trillion. By 1900, that had tripled to $3.4 trillion. And if things go, and today it's about $100 trillion. So think about that. The economy's grown 100-fold. World population has grown 8-fold over that period of time. The result is in 1900, average per capita income on the globe was $2,000 in real dollars. Today it's $10,000. And if the economy continues to grow at a normal rate, which we've seen because of the advantages of liberty that came into existence in the late 18th century, the world's economy should be about $250 billion by 2100. And average per capita income would be somewhere around $80,000 to $90,000 per capita on the planet. That would be an amazing increase. In 1820, There's a definition of absolute poverty. Absolute poverty is about $2 per day. In 1820, in real dollars again, 84% of the population lived in poverty, in absolute poverty. By 1990, that had dropped down to 36%, and as of last week, the World Bank said it's down to 10%. Now, absolute poverty could be gone on planet Earth by in another decade or so if we continue in these trends. Life expectancy. In 1820, average life expectancy was 30 years. 30 years. It is now 72 years, and if the current rates, and I actually think they're going to speed up, and if things work out the way I want them to work out, I'll still be here in 2100. But if we can continue with these trends, average life expectancy will rise from 72 years on planet Earth now to about 92 years in 2100. An interesting fact to note about the United States, average life expectancy in 1900 was 47 years. And only 4% of the population made it past age 65. This month, I will hit that milestone. And now it's 16% of the American population is over age 65. And for the first time in all of human history, there are more people over age 65 than there are children under age 5 on the planet. It's an amazing difference that's going on. So what happened to population? In 1900, world population was 1.6 billion people. And when I was born, it was about 3 billion people. And it's now 7.6. The people in this room, there will never, ever be another doubling of human population. That we've seen, we're through that. It's over. The demographic transition is taking place. And what will likely happen over the course of this century is the population will peak at about 9 billion in the middle of the century, and drop back to about 8 billion by 2100, and possibly continue to fall over that period of time. And I think I celebrate that because I'm not worried about overpopulation or anything like that. I celebrate that because it means that people have gained control of their reproduction. They are making decisions on their part. They're not having to just do what nature tells them to do, so to speak. Interesting, though, when I was reporting on this, one of the most interesting things I came across was some work that some anthropologists did. The following seems to be a regularity, is that in countries where women believe that they're not going to live past age 50 on average, they have 5 to 6 children. When they believe they're going to live between 60 and 70 years, they have 2.5 children. And if they believe they're going to live to more than 75, it goes to 1.7 children over time. Again, this is showing the empowerment of women over time. The good news is, again, average life expectancy is 72 years. So I expect these reproduction trends to continue over the remainder of the century. Going to the one other thing, literacy again in 1820, basically 90% of people were illiterate. Today, 93% of women between ages 16 and 25 are literate, and 96% of men are. It's an amazing transformation over that time. So, what is going to happen also is I believe that urbanization is going to be the main trend. For the about 5 years ago, for the first time in all of history, 50% of humanity lived in cities. By the end of the century, it's going to be 85 to 90%. And this will, even with a slightly larger population at the end, that means that the 3.6 billion people, I know it's a lot of numbers, who are living on the landscape now, a lot of them subsistence farmers, will be living in cities and being a lot wealthier. This means that we will be withdrawing from nature. There'll be a lot more land reverting to nature now. And that process has already begun. There was a wonderful study reported in Nature magazine a month ago, which basically said between 1982 and 2016, tree cover on planet Earth expanded by 900,000 miles, square miles, over that time. Again, showing that humanity is already withdrawing from nature and leaving more space for other creatures to thrive and survive over that period of time. And I believe that will certainly continue. Another way of thinking about this, Jesse Ossible and his colleagues at Rockefeller University call this peak farmland. And by which he points out is we're becoming so productive in agriculture, we can grow more and more food on less and less land over time. And we had basically 153 million square miles of hectares of land, and by 2060 that'll be down to about only 100 million square miles hectares. We're going to be dramatically reducing our footprint on Earth. And so by the end of the 20th century, we're going to be vastly wealthier. I mean, the 21st century, we're going to be vastly wealthier, living in cities and having a great deal of nature to enjoy as we go out of our cities to frolic, as it were. The world is only going to get better over this century if we can just keep liberty going. Anyway, thank you very much.
That almost eradicated what Peter Suderman did to us in the last panel. You have to give us like a Terminator 3 reference instead of the Terminator 2 one. Michael Shermer, Catherine, when is the Charlton Heston video from? There was a great Charlton Heston video that was advertising the Reason Foundation from like 20, it might have been our 25th anniversary or the 20th, or maybe it was just around that time. Anyways, like 25 years ago, Charlton Heston is out there and he's got a tweed jacket on and he's looking at the Reason Foundation. And it's so compelling and convincing. I don't even know what he said. It didn't matter. But one thing he didn't say in that video, talking about all the wonderful work that we've done in privatization and the magazine, all this kind of stuff, he didn't talk about how we are going to edit the human genome. Like it's impossible to see certain things in advance. And yet, within the last 25 years, we've gone from not having any idea about how this stuff works to talking about like micro tailoring individual drugs. So Michael Shermer, to you, give us an overview or a little bit of like, how did we get to this place? And what is our current level of understanding and trajectory with just looking at the damn genome?
Right. Well, like Ron, I'm a optimist by temperament, but a realist by intellect, I hope. I think we should remember Stein's law, trends that can't go on forever won't. Just let that float there for a minute. You know, this idea that if we can just get our mind around the genome, then we're going to get to live forever. For example, we can cure all these diseases and so on. My latest book is on this topic, Heavens on Earth, kind of tracking secular scientific versions of the afterlife and immortality. I'm already an atheist, so I don't have to deal with the other ones. But there are people today who are absolutely convinced that we're the chosen generation. We're the ones that get to live forever, primarily because of science and technology. So these are people like Ray Kurzweil and the Singularity, and you know Ray has this idea that you know if we can extend life 1 year for every year, then that's the takeoff point. You get to live forever. Again, Stein's law, it can't go on forever. It's not a linear curve like this. It's an asymptotic curve. The curve is going to get closer and closer to the upper ceiling, and what modern medicine and genomics and so on can do is just push more and more of us up toward the upper ceiling. But the upper ceiling is still there, and we're not going to break through that anytime soon. Not in our generation, I think. So just a couple points on that. Although I will say that there's a corollary to Stein's law. I forget whose it is, has a name, but it's that trends that can't go on forever can go on much longer than you think they can. So there's a little good news there. So I deal with cryonics and the transhumanists and the mind uploaders and all these theories and to which they say to me, Shermer, don't you want to live to be 500 years old? And my response is, look, just get me to 90 without prostate cancer and to 100 without Alzheimer's and 105 without senility. And when I'm in a bed all hooked up to, you know, and I'm not even living really, so in other words, I think what the technologies, things like genomics can do is just solve certain specific problems, which looks to be much, much harder than we ever realized. So, for example, the war on cancer, we're still fighting it. There is no cancer. Like, it's just one thing. And if we could just nail down the genome of cancer in some generic, no such thing. There's hundreds of types of cancers. They all have different genomics behind them. And it's worse than that. Every person who has that particular kind of cancer has a unique genome of that cancer. So, you know, personalized genomic testing for your particular tumor or cancer is going to be different from everybody else's. And so the medical treatment of that will be unique to you and you alone. And so we're getting a handle on that. But, you know, we're, again, a long ways from that. Hitch had that done when he got his esophageal cancer, Christopher Hitchens. And ironically, given that he's such an outspoken atheist, it was Francis Collins, head of the who was head of the Human Genome Project and head of the National Institutes of Health, also a born-again evangelical Christian, was his treating doctor. So I thought there was some. And he's still dead, so I guess it didn't work. As a little editorial cartoon to show the people at the funeral, you know, we're gathered here today because your prayers didn't work. All right, so I went and did the 23andMe for one of my Scientific American columns, and I'll just give you my review of it. I'm in favor of personal genomics. I think it's great. Just get all the information you can, but I think it can be oversold either by the company or by the media or in your own mind. So I spent into the thing. It was $200, mailed it in, and you know the routine. I'm sure many of you have done it. So it was super accurate on my ancestry, which I knew the details of already, so no problem there. It got it down to 99.7% accurate. Okay, good. It predicted I can smell asparagus in my urine, yes, taste bitter and have hazel eyes, ring fingers longer than index fingers, very little freckling, and straight light hair. Okay, so far so good. It did say that I didn't have any of the variants for Parkinson's disease, sickle cell anemia, and most importantly, Alzheimer's. Yay. So I'm like, okay, I'm not going to get Alzheimer's. So I'm going to go back to eating meat and not exercising. No. But wait, 23andMe also says I have no bald spot. Now, I have a really good hair person. So if you look at the right angle, it looks like that's correct. But let's see. No cheek dimples. No, I have one. A little upper back hair. A slight unibrow. No. No widow's peak. I do. And a longer big toe than your second toe. So these are all wrong. So if a genetic test for such comparatively simple physical features can be mistaken, what does that say about its accuracy for more complex diseases like Alzheimer's? So the report says our reports do not include all possible genetic variants that could affect these conditions. Other factors can also affect your risk of developing these conditions, including lifestyle, environment, and family history. Well, that's everything. For toe length, for example, 56% of research participants with results like mine, that is, I had 15 genetic markers for a longer big toe, 13 genetic markers for a longer second toe, have longer big toes, but I'm in the 44%. So a prediction barely better than 50-50 isn't terribly expedient. And so, and the thing for Alzheimer's is way more complex than that. They can code for four different variants, but there's many, many more based on that. So I went to Harvard's Rudy Tanzi, who's head of their genomics and Alzheimer's research team. And, you know, he kind of dashed some cold water on the whole thing. I mean, it's good to know, but, you know, keep doing the Sudoku puzzles or whatever, even though there's no evidence that they do anything to curtail Alzheimer's. Anyway, so I sort of concluded, like, you know, all information is good. Get as much as you can, don't oversell it in your mind. We have a long, long ways to go before we can get there, wherever there is.
I recall going with David Knott up to Silicon Valley. This is one of the pleasures of being the editor of the magazine, is that you go with the president of the foundation and let's just go meet and talk to people, see what's going on. And Silicon Valley is always great because I have no idea what any of them are talking about. And we were there maybe in 2011, and a guy, and if he's in this room, I'm really sorry for how I'm going to portray you, was like I've never done cocaine, but I imagine that people who were on it talk really fast. Is that what I understand? And they like to hang out in the bathroom and whatever. So anyway, he was talking really, really, really fast. And it was all about how blockchain technology is going to undermine the nation state as we know it. And it was amazing. It lasted like 3 hours. I got so much in my brain. I didn't understand a word of what he was talking about. It made no intrinsic sense to me at all. It's been phenomenal to watch its development, the development of Bitcoin and other things since then. I think 2 weeks ago or so, I interviewed Patrick Byrne from Overstock.com, who's a huge business evangelist of it. And he came so close to making me understand what it actually meant. I mean, it was on the verge. Like, I was at 95%. But anyways, Jim Epstein has been doing some of the best work of anybody out there journalistically talking about the implications of blockchain, of Bitcoin, how it's affecting Venezuela, for Christ's sakes. So, Jim, can you give us a little bit of a sort of an overview of how we went from zero to wherever the hell we are now? And is it indeed going to undermine the nation state in a way that's going to make Thad Russell happy?
Okay. So, well, to get into the topic, I want to talk about a startup, a blockchain startup called Protium, that was promising to bring transparency to the global market in fruits and vegetables. So the idea was to create a system in which every pear, apple, cantaloupe, and zucchini at the grocery store had a barcode that shoppers could scan with their phones to bring up information about where they were grown, whether they were genetically modified. And a version of this kind of thing already exists, but the information is stored on a central database maintained by the International Federation for Produce Standards. So the idea of Protium was to put the same data on a blockchain. So what is a blockchain? The simplest definition is it's a database that can't be tampered with, that's open access so anyone can read the information stored on it, and that can't be deleted because there are constantly updated copies of it stored on computers all over the world. So since a blockchain is controlled by nobody and belongs to nobody, Protium would be turning the information about our produce over to the people. It's sort of a democratization, eliminating the central actor. And there's another really important detail to understand this concept, which is that this blockchain for fruits and vegetables would also have a new currency baked into it. Kind of like those tokens that you get at the amusement park or the arcade or Chuck E. Cheese. So every barcode slapped on a fruit or vegetable would have to be purchased with one of these tokens. And before the system even launched, the Protium founders would sell these tokens on the open market and use the revenue to pay for the development of their technology. So in the future, when the Dole Food Company needs to buy these tokens to pay for the labels on their pineapples, the price would rise and investors would make money. So that's the basic concept. And there are blockchain ventures that follow this model. Instead of fruits and vegetables, maybe it's artwork, maybe it's music, land titles, data storage. Many of these systems also do have the same idea of tokens baked into the system, such as Dentacoin, which is marketed as the blockchain solution for the global dentistry industry. Whatever product or service you can think of, someone is probably trying to put it on a blockchain. So what happened to Protium? Shortly after a few investors bought these tokens, the website disappeared. And if you typed the URL in, you were greeted instead by a completely white background and a single word printed on tiny type on the top left corner of the webpage. Penis.
This is the future libertarians want.
The founders had disappeared. And there are other versions of this story. It's really kind of no mystery that something new, exciting, difficult to understand with a baked-in revenue model would become a magnet for hucksters. And for every scam, there are also 10 just truly terrible ideas, such as Pawtocall, a blockchain solution for the pet community, or Nurse Token, which aims to ease the global nursing shortage by putting it on a blockchain. And yet, what I want to focus on today is why I'm still actually excited about the potential of this technology. And that's because there are a few exciting projects carried out by serious computer scientists with really sound ideas. And most of them, they're not specific to certain industries. The vision is to use the blockchain to rebuild the structure of our computing networks and the internet itself, which is, I think, really vital. So one issue is the growing power of Google, Facebook, and Twitter is actually alarming. And there are a few blockchain projects that are trying to use this new form of database as the bedrock for a new ecosystem of social media services that put individuals back in control of their identities and data. So there would still be a private company like Facebook, but they would have a lot less control, and it would be much easier to migrate your identity and all your photos and all of your information to a different service. So it would make them a lot more competitive. You would own your own identity. That's often the idea. So our identities are often tied into Facebook or Twitter. You know, you can verify your identity by clicking on your Facebook profile. This idea is to kind of use the blockchain to do that in a decentralized way, so no company is in control of that. And really the idea is to make good on the unfulfilled promise of the internet. It's sort of like a half-baked revolution. The idea was to have it be a real peer-to-peer platform that shifts power from governments and large corporations to individual users. And then one other thing I want to mention, a related problem that blockchain technology can help solve, is that our computing, current computing architecture is built on sand. And this is becoming a really big problem. Today, the security model is what I'm talking about. Today, that could mean that hackers get a hold of your credit card number or expose your participation on the adultery website Ashley Madison. A few years from now, it could mean that a hacker sends your self-driving car accelerating into a crowd. So there are some really interesting ventures that are attempting to use the blockchain as the foundation for rebuilding our computer systems in a much more secure manner. Okay, thanks.
So this has been mostly optimistic so far. Ron, I think your last words in what you said is, if we don't screw it up. So let's talk about the if we don't screw it up. What are you worried about that could be impediments to or diversions from what you see as a pretty positive world in 2100?
My next article, I guess, will deal with this a little bit. It's on the problem or the issue of algocracy, governance by algorithm. And one of the things that I'm afraid of, and I discuss it, is the model of governance that the Chinese are developing now called the social credit model. Mm. And basically, by 2020, every Chinese person will have a social credit score that will be public. And it's a three-digit number, and they're also going to be 500, they hope at this point, 570 million cameras with facial recognition software behind them so that nobody will ever be able to hide again. And so the social credit scores will be not only about, you know, you pay your taxes and your bills and so forth, but it will also be how is your blog acceptable to the communist government and so forth. And so you could see this as a model spreading across the globe, because this is what you do is by creating a social credit score is you kind of gamify obedience, is that everyone wants to have a higher score. And one of the ways that you get a higher score is not to hang out with people who have low scores. If you do that, your score goes down. And so the idea here is that you will urge your, you know, low life friends to get better, higher scores, or you'll dump them. And right now, and it's already working in China the following way is that if you have a low score, you can't buy tickets on a high speed train. You can't buy an airplane ticket. You can't get into good hotels. Your internet speed, if you can have internet speed, is still dial up. I mean, this is a possible model of the world that does scare me a little bit.
Michael, you're more guardedly optimistic than Ron is in general, or at least you have a lower desire to live until you're 1,000 years old.
By the way, Michael will live a lot longer than he thinks. But
do you guys have a bet?
So. I hope so. I just went and did that calcium chest scan thing of your heart. So I went out and had a set of ribs that night because mine was low. So I'm not going to have it done again for a few more months. Anyway,
no. What obstacles are about the things that you care about and the trajectories that you're happy about or feel like are going in a good,
well,
good
along
direction?
Well, along the lines of what Ron just described is government control of technologies, particularly genomics, that would end up restricting the kind of research we need to have done on it. I can be skeptical of how far this can take us in terms of the technology, but I'm totally in favor of not having a precautionary principle and just let people do whatever they want, because the chances of something really bad going wrong are pretty slim unless the government gets involved, in which case it could be disastrous. And here I'm just thinking of something like IVF back in the 80s. That was a huge thing where the government was concerned, the Catholic Church was concerned, playing God, all this stuff. Now, 1.3% of all babies born are born by IVF. And no one makes those arguments anymore. And that's pretty much how most technologies go. So just let people do whatever they want. I mean, if you want to clone yourself, people that clone their pets, if human cloning was ever available, there's always these fears about, people will just clone themselves. First of all, not many people would once they realize it's not actually them. It's the same thing of the mind uploading. You know, you scan the connectome and you upload it into the cloud and you turn it on and there you are like Johnny Depp in the computer in that movie Transcendent Man. No, it's just a copy of you. Your copy's having a great good time in the future and you're dead in the grave. Okay, it's not you. It's the problem of identity. So I think these things would work themselves out if we just let people do whatever they want. And I'll always err on the side of just letting people experiment until, unless there was some, you know, huge catastrophe looming before we need to step in and restrict it.
By the way, if anyone wants to clone me, go ahead.
Is Pam in the audience? We would like to get a reading on that one. Jim, is the cat out of the bag on blockchain or cryptocurrency? And I'm glad that my brain at least understands that there's a difference between those two concepts. Finally, can governments choke this thing off at some point, including the United States government here? At some point, are they going to realize, hold on a second, a competitive currency to us? Yeah. That's not going to fly.
Yeah, well, I think you're talking specifically about Bitcoin, which I think is it's the biggest and it's got the best chance of actually working as a non-governmental currency. I think it's getting harder and harder. You know, in the very early days of Bitcoin, it would have been possible to stop it and to shut it down. Now it's pretty difficult because this is a completely borderless technology. It exists in different countries. It's very easy to hide it. It's getting easier. Like there's all this, there's been a lot of progress in making it increasingly private. I think the government could do a lot of harm in terms of slowing its development. But I don't think I think we're kind of hit the point where Bitcoin is pretty much unstoppable at this point. And there's also, you hear I think what we're going to hear more and more is about the energy use that goes into Bitcoin. People are alarmed. There's a lot of bad stats out there Bitcoin has baked into it this process called mining, which is how you secure the Bitcoin network. And I won't go into really any more detail, but basically you can turn electricity into currency. And this is a growing phenomenon and it's happening all over the place. And there's a lot of alarm that this is contributing to global warming. And I don't think it can really be stopped because you can have a Bitcoin miner hidden under your desk and you plug it in and you can earn Bitcoin in fees and newly minted Bitcoin. And this is just going to keep happening.
Can you briefly tell us, because it's just crazy story, what the hell is Bitcoin being used for and doing in Venezuela?
Yeah, so in Venezuela, which of course is experiencing a hyperinflation, so the currency has collapsed. Bitcoin is actually being used as a currency. It's easy to hide. You can buy things. Bitcoin has some problems in it. There are still transaction fees, etc. But in Venezuela, it's so much better than the alternative. Dollars are very hard to find in the country, and Bitcoin can be used without permission from a bank. It also, there are currency capital controls in Venezuela. So the government restricts the movement of money in and out of the country, and Bitcoin gets around that. Bitcoin is a currency that runs on the internet. So the government's fictitious fixed exchange rate doesn't apply. So people are actually using Bitcoin. And another real key to this is that how do you get Bitcoin into Venezuela? How do you get Venezuelans, how do you create liquidity in the Bitcoin market in Venezuela? And there's actually a way, which is that the socialist government in Venezuela basically does not charge for electricity. So of course, the enterprising miners, and I mean, it is growing so fast, and there are actually foreigners that are running huge Bitcoin mines in Venezuela. The government is now running Bitcoin mines. You can turn that free electricity into something that people will accept for food. And you can use a site called eGifter to turn the Bitcoin you just made with the free electricity that you took and mined. You can buy some credits on Amazon and then you can have food shipped in from Amazon. And this is a growing practice in Venezuela.
Wow. So we finally discovered the route around socialism, the lasting one here. Ron, in our previous panel, Boyd and Gray was talking about how we're kind of unlearning some of the lessons of Adam Smith, particularly about the evils and wrongthink of mercantilism, right? I got that this time. So a lot of your overall sense of realism, optimism is tied to the increase in wealth over time. So are you worried in this moment that we are seeing a retreat back into a more mercantilist way of thinking worldwide, and that that is going to significantly slow what has been a pretty good roll?
Obviously, I am worried about that. I do think that that is a problem. One of the person I think about when I think about these issues is Manser Olson, and he read a wonderful book about the rise and decline of nations. And his concern is that what happens is as nation states and governments grow, they become more complicated over time. The regulations outgrow the economy in a certain sense, and eventually it kills growth. And he documented this phenomenon, unfortunately, throughout human history. And he was concerned was is that we are at a particular moment where this might occur here. And I do worry about that. On the flip side of it, because there is more global competition, as it were, in the world, I think that there will be places where liberty will continue to exist, and that as a whole, humanity will improve over time, that essentially growth will continue. If not here, though I hope here, it will happen in other places. And there'll be technologies like the blockchain that will enable that. That it is a kind of decentralized platform for getting around governance blockades, as it were. So ultimately, I think that there's still considerable hope, largely because people are more educated. They have they have a model for how to become wealthier over time. And in the old days, people didn't have that model. We do have that now. We know what to do. We still have people who try to stop it, but I think we'll be able to work around it.
Michael, you've been laboring in the salt mines of skepticism for a long time. Sort of looking back at your career and where we are now, where we were before, do you feel like your battle of ideas winning more than losing? Are we in a better place intellectually in dealing with science, just kind of as a country in the discourse, than we were when you first started?
Yeah, I think so. And of course, the time scale is all important compared to, say, 500 years ago, when people burned women as witches as the solution to diseases and famines and accidents and things. Yeah, we've come a long way since then. If you just take like the last 25 years, I think there's progress, although it's up and down, and the particular beliefs that people hold vary considerably based on pop culture and what's in. You know, exorcisms are not a big thing like they were in the 70s as an issue. When I got into it in the 90s, creationism was the big threat. Holocaust denial was kind of rising. Those have largely subsided now. And there's other issues related to, say, alternative medicine and cancer quackery, things like that that have risen that we have to combat. Vaccines as a cause of autism is still around, unbelievably. It just kind of depends. We know that education helps somewhat, but the percentages of college graduates or even people with graduate degrees who believe in, you know, all kinds of conspiracy theories and alternative medicine claims and things like that is pretty alarming. They're not applying critical thinking skills to that. We know there are some kind of deprogramming educational tools you can use to make people alert to their cognitive biases, like the confirmation bias and the hindsight bias and those sorts of things. That helps move the needle a little bit, but unfortunately, there's also another bias that says I am now really good at recognizing the cognitive biases in other people and look at how biased they are. Fortunately, I'm not. And that is not the case. So that's also a problem. So it's just one of these kind of ongoing things. And in terms of like the influence of religion on public life, I'm encouraged by, I think, the rise of the nuns, the percentage of people that have no religious affiliation. They tick the box for none on their religious affiliation. That was like in the small single digits in the 90s, and it's about 25% of all Americans now, 33% of millennials, and probably about half of iGeners. have no religious affiliation. No, they're not necessarily atheist, agnostic, skeptics, subscribers to Skeptic Magazine. No, but they may be followers of Deepak Chopra or some sort of, you know, Buddhist quantum consciousness thing or whatever. But at least, which is fine, because at least they're not backing large, powerful religious organizations that influence political life. Or the restriction of technologies like, say, IVF that I mentioned, or the teaching of evolution and science in science classes like creationists did. So that's a big trend in the right direction, I think.
We have, I think, about seven, eight minutes left. So I wanted to launch the Jerry Orstrom Hour. Jerry, what's your... there you are. What's your question, Jerry? This was, there is, and it's also a double mind trick. I'm preventing you from asking a question by, we're going to do card tricks, Jerry. If we're going to burn that wallet. Jerry, do you have a question?
What is the future of optimism? I mean, as a society, culturally, we remain very, very pessimistic. You know better than I. 5, 10, 20 years from now, will people get it? Will most people be as optimistic as you are and I am? Boy, that was a tough one, wasn't it?
My confirmation bias says, of course they'll understand and read more of our books, and they'll. Yeah. The problem, as you know, is that everybody has a lot of people have a pessimism bias. It's actually I think that Steven Pinker had a nice way of putting it is that people who sound quote optimistic sound like they're trying to sell you something, and people who sound pessimistic sound like they're trying to help you. And the problem is that pessimism sells. Things are going to be terrible. And it's just a cognitive bias that humanity has always had. And another way, you know, I'm sure you've heard this before, is that we are actually, evolutionarily speaking, the result of the scaredy cats. What happened is that the guy who, you know, was walking down the plains of Africa, and he heard a rustle in the bushes and said, that's the wind. And it turned out to be a lion, he got selected out. But the one who heard the wind and said, that could be a lion, and ran away, they are our ancestors. And so we are the people who always are worried about things going wrong and never being able to think about things going right. It's a lot harder to think about going wrong than it is to think about going right. Fortunately, we've created institutions that have an optimistic bias, which is science, among other things, free speech, and those are overcoming our inherent biases over time, I believe. And if, so long as we sustain those institutions, things will, in fact, get a lot better, against our better will.
To add to that, to take a point that Nick Gillespie makes sometimes, which is that for some reason, when the future arrives, when that big innovation comes, we immediately flip to taking it for granted and just complaining about its deficiencies. I don't know why that is, but it seems to be true. So I think that's a factor also.
Before I pass the mic to the next person, I'll just give you a distinction between pessimists and optimists. An optimist thinks that this is the best of all possible worlds, and a pessimist knows that it is.
You're calling on Matt.
It's a good question. You, sir, since you're closer to Jerry.
This is really great, especially for a Reason fanboy, so I appreciate all of you and your insights. I have a question, sort of, Jim, you have been looking at the internet component of blockchain and all that. I'm a web developer by day, right? And the days of like rolling your own for, you know, hosting and computing power and all the rest are sort of gone. And now when you have a startup, you have like three choices. You go to Amazon, Google, or Microsoft for your computing power. And so while there's a great democratization going on, there's also a very significant consolidation going on. And there's, you know, deplatforming and things like that that are issues there. So I don't know if we're sort of just watching sort of like the supernova contract and then expand again, and maybe there will be a great liberty-minded cloud provider that I can switch to from Google next year. But I don't know if you've looked at sort of that consolidate. The bigger the internet gets, the fewer people actually provide it to us.
I think, you know, the sort of stages of the internet, I think, are it started out as a truly a peer-to-peer platform where it was individuals interacting, and email is kind of actually a peer-to-peer. Originally, you had a server in your house, or maybe you had a server that was in your community and that, you know, you dialed in, and it really started out that way. And then we transitioned over time to these big central services like Google and Facebook, et cetera. And the reason was because the functionality was better. You didn't need to worry about, like, does people remember, like, backing up the files on their computer, such a pain in the ass. And now you don't have to worry about that. It's a better world in that sense. So the vision of, you know, I've said there's a handful of projects that I do think are exciting. One of them is called Blockstack. And the vision they talk about is using the idea that this in this next stage, we can have the best of both worlds. So we can both own our own identities and it can be truly peer-to-peer, but we can have all of the functionality. So that's the promise. I think there are computer science problems that haven't yet been solved to get us there, but that's definitely the vision.
Yes. You. Yes. Microphone.
Bill Eggers, a Reason alumni. I wanted to touch on a little bit more of the gene editing and CRISPR area. I've had the opportunity over the last few months to spend time with some of the top researchers, Jennifer Doudna from Berkeley, Ethan Beer from UCSD, and they're a little bit more optimistic, I would say, about where we are than you were, Michael, and I want to hear from Ron on this too. Essentially, that what we're seeing with an agricultural standpoint could be, you know, massive revolution in terms of anti being able to protect from pests and so forth. Finally giving Africa that opportunity to be the breadbasket of the world if they accept it. And then we're already seeing a lot of this happening on animals, as you know. And then when you look at humans, Jennifer's feeling was that within a decade, you'll be able to go to an IVF clinic and basically have a designer baby. We're going to start off by eliminating a variety of diseases and so forth. And then you've got all these incredible moral sort of ethical issues. And what we're also seeing is that a lot of the top researchers in this area are moving their labs to China because they're able to do this on humans already, and that China might end up having a big edge on us and throughout the West because of a lot of those sort of ethical issues that we're going to struggle with for decades, maybe in the West, and they're going to go straight for kind of human enhancement. So I'd like to get your opinions on where we are there and where do you think we're going?
Yeah, I think those things usually take longer than the original authors project. I read Jennifer's book. It's a great book. But this, you know, 10 years away, it's like with AI. I've been hearing since I was in college, which was more than 10 years ago now. Which is technically true. You know, we're 5 years away from AI, or we're 10 years away from AI, and always will be, it looks like. I think a lot of these are just much harder problems. So again, if we could just specifically target with CRISPR that particular cancer with that person today, okay, that, you know, that I can kind of see happening year after year, cumulatively getting us there, wherever there is, in the next decade. You know, to go from there to, you know, we're going to live to be 100, you know, 90% of humans live to be 100, something like that. You know, we're a long ways from something like that, or even breaking through the upper ceiling, which is about 120. No one's ever lived more than 120. Things fall apart pretty quickly after 90. And there's no technologies that could do that except for, you know, a genomic kind of reprogramming. And but it's even way more complex than that, because it's not just the genes, it's the whole environment of the cells and all the other factors that come into play. That's not going to be 10 years away. I think that's a lot longer.
Ron, we're getting there.
On the China issue, I think what will happen is, if you're very likely right, is that a lot of people are going to move to China to do that. But what will happen is there'll be a Sputnik moment that some lab in China will do something that will be so amazing that all of a sudden, I hope that our country will go, you know what, our ethical rules are a little too complicated here, and let's take this back. And that progress will go a lot faster here because we have a free, open scientific culture in a way that China doesn't have. So what we need is to have, you know, them scare us, and then we'll finally come back to our senses.
Please join me in thanking three of the smartest SOBs in the world, Michael Shermer, Jim Epstein, and Ron Bailey. It's a treat to be able to learn so much, and considering what little I have to work with personally.
Hope you enjoyed that special presentation of the Reason podcast from our 50th anniversary celebration. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else. This has been Matt Welch. Thank you very much for listening.